order the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. We are going to skip the minutes for the moment and go directly to our first bill on our agenda, which is House File 817, Representative Feist. I will move House File 817 be recommended be placed on the General Register. I will also move the DE2 amendment for Representative Feist, which I understand is an author's amendment that gets the bill in the shape the author would like the committee to consider it. I'm trying to speak very slowly so that Representative Feist has all the time she needs to get situated.
I'm ready.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add about the DE2 amendment, Representative Feist?
I think for now just it is in the shape that I wish it to be in.
Okay.
For now.
Any discussion to the DE2? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. DE2 is adopted. Representative Feist, do your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. So I would like to start out by thanking the Manufactured and Modular Home Association and All Parks Alliance for Change for working together quite extensively over the past week to come up with this new version of the bill before you. There are some additional conversations going on about some of the peripheral issues and how this bill is structured, but they do not get to the heart of the most challenging issues that we have had to negotiate over. And so I'm very excited about this bill, even though we have a few more conversations to have. Manufactured home parks provide a vital, affordable housing option as compared with traditional stick-built homes and apartment units. Over 180,000 individuals live in about 900 licensed parks, 80% of whom are low or very low income. These communities represent nearly 50,000 households in nearly all 87 counties. This bill is simple. It will require community owners to notify residents of an opportunity to purchase their manufactured housing communities. This version of the bill before you explicitly delineates the scope of the bill and which transactions it covers and does not cover. It provides protocols for notice that are workable for all. Which was very hard, but we got there. It creates a timeline that is reasonable for both residents and park owners. It incorporates remedies that are meaningful but don't create skewed incentives on either side. And it references tax incentives to be incorporated via a separate bill once we finalize that specific language. And you'll notice where it says when it goes into effect, it just says like when we pass a tax bill. That will be more specific once we have that exact language. It turns out that in Minnesota, we don't exactly have a capital gains tax, and so we're trying to create an analogous tax incentive. This is good policy. Resident-owned manufactured housing communities have proven to make deeper investments in improving their communities, more regularly replacing roads, upgrading water and sewer systems, building storm shelters, and adding playgrounds while keeping rent increases to as little as $6. So I will turn it over to my experts, and I would encourage you to support this bill.
All right. We will start with David Anderson. Mr. Anderson, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, which is the statewide association representing the 180,000 residents of manufactured home park communities. I want to thank the committee for dedicating time today to manufactured housing, and particularly House File 817, the Resident Opportunity to Purchase Bill. As Representative Feist pointed out, it's a very simple proposal in that it just requires notice from the community owners to the homeowners when there's potential sale. Currently, residents only receive notice that a park is available for sale if it's in a formal real estate listing or a public advertisement, which these communities are almost never sold in that fashion. The proposal doesn't require the community owner to sell the land to the residents or to lower their price. It doesn't prevent the community owner from seeking other offers. It simply provides residents with that transparency and opportunity to put in an offer. The community owners still have the exclusive right to determine what properties they want to sell and who they want to sell them to. It is an important proposal because who owns the communities can have an impact. Currently there is a very significant push from out-of-state buyers to acquire the properties as quickly as they can. In the last 5 years, 18% of the home park lots have changed hands, and 55% of the sales have gone to out-of-state buyers. And a year ago, it was 70% of sales going to out-of-state buyers. And what we find in sort of digging into the operations of those particular communities is that they, for example, 10 of the 10 communities in the Twin Cities metro area with the highest rents are all owned by these larger chains. As Representative Feist mentioned, it's an important bill. There have been a lot of good conversations both during the last biennium and since the beginning of this session about how to improve and make sure that the proposal is narrowly focused on its intended purpose and that it's clear for both parties, and we think a lot of progress has been made there. So certainly I encourage the committee to support House File 817, and I'm available to answer questions that I can be helpful with.
Thank you, sir. We do have two other people who signed up to testify. We'll start with Mark Bruner. How do I think I say that? Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Bruner with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 817. As amended, we think it's a much improved bill over the original version that we started from. But briefly, MMHA was established in 1951, and we're one of Minnesota's oldest trade associations. We represent the builders of manufactured and modular homes in Minnesota. We have a total of 15 plants in the state, and we also speak for Minnesota's nearly 1,000 privately owned manufactured home communities who have nearly 50,000 home sites that are considered Minnesota's largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing. I'd like to thank Representative Feist for her genuine and thoughtful involvement in reaching an agreement between the community owners, AIPAC, and the North Country Foundation lobbyists with the language that's before you that recognizes more how the real estate market works in terms of transactions and selling a manufactured home community. And as Representative Feist indicated, we're still working on some tax language to try to make that work more in conformance with what Minnesota has in place relative to taxation on income versus taxation on capital gains, which we don't have a tax on. So in conclusion, Minnesota currently is one of the top states in the nation in terms of affording rights and opportunities for residents to purchase their community, whether it's being offered for sale to the public or through a real estate broker with a notification, or if there were to be a closure, they have a right of first refusal to purchase the property. So this will be essentially one more tool in their box in terms of increasing resident ownership. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Matt Spellman. Board, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Spellman. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Minnesota Realtors is a statewide business trade association with a membership of over 22,000 real estate professionals working with buyers and sellers of all types of property all across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to provide brief comments on House File 817 as amended. I testified in the House Housing Committee where this was originally heard and shared our concerns. I'm going to be far more brief today. I want to express our appreciation to Representative Feist for her willingness to meet with us and hear out some of our concerns, and we appreciate the stakeholders that have been working on this to reach a compromise. Given the timing of this amendment, and the fact that I was wrangling my 2-year-old sick daughter last night, we haven't had a whole lot of time to review this or share it with our members. If our members have any concerns, we would welcome any opportunity to work with the bill author and the other stakeholders to potentially find a solution to address those concerns. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts today.
Well, thank you for coming today. Hope your daughter's doing better, and I know that Representative Feist is always open to discussion. All right, we have no other people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. So I see on line 325 through 328, so if the a representative acting on behalf of the residents decides to purchase the property, it must stay a mobile home park for the next 10 years. And certainly we don't hope for this to happen, but what happens if by chance it fails?
I think, Representative Farr, I don't know if this provision is in the DE, but I think you're looking at the bill that came into committee and not the DE on the line that you were talking about. But while you're looking over there, I'll let Representative Feist comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what line and what we're referencing. So
in the section in that Representative Farr mentioned is requiring requirement of affordable housing preservation, lines 325 to 328.
Oh. Yeah. So it's not. I'm Mr. Chair.
It looks like it's line 47 to 410, maybe.
Correct. Yes. Sorry about that. I was looking at the wrong.
In the DE2. I don't know if that's identical language.
Okay, now I've got the section. I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Good, Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. So my apologies. I was looking at the bill rather than the amendment. So, yes, 4.7 to 4.10. So, you know, a representative acting on behalf of the agents can purchase the property, and it needs to be a mobile home park for the next 10 years. And certainly we don't hope for this to happen, but what if it fails? What if on year four it fails, and are they – able to sell it for highest and best use, or do they have to sell it as a mobile home park, or how does that work?
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. I actually will turn over to my experts. We do have a remedy section, but it does not relate to that specific scenario. So Mr. Anderson, or perhaps Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. Certainly, the intent of this was just to make sure that if a right is established, given that the perceived public benefit is to make sure that affordable housing is preserved, that is what in fact happens if this right is exercised. I don't know that we, in the language, really went as far in the discussions, really imagining worst case scenarios like that. But there's nothing in this language that would, I assume, prevent any other lawful practices actions that might be taken in the case of a failing business to be taken, you know, if it's a bankruptcy or foreclosure or whatever the scenario might be. There's nothing in here that would, you know, bar those kinds of proceedings from going forward. I hope that helps.
Representative Farr.
Correct. So that I understand. My question is, if it would go to foreclosure, does the 10 years still stand? And so the only thing that it can be sold as is a mobile home park rather than highest and best use.
Mr. Anderson?
It's something that we may have to look into. We didn't really go down the path of imagining worst case scenarios like that.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dobbs.
Thank you, Representative or Chair Howard, or you may as well change your name to Chair Howard.
You're going to call me Chair Howard? I take that as a compliment. That's good.
Representative Feist, a question I've got is, are there any other areas in the state of Minnesota where we actually have similar situations like this, where the state has requirements of who can and cannot acquire certain particular types of property? I guess this is a little bit new to me, and I'm just trying to get my arms wrapped around this a little bit more.
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. Thank you for the question. So there are a number of other states that have very similar opportunity to purchase lots. As an immigration lawyer, the one example I'm thinking of in terms of like conveyance of property is that there are weird or very specific rules around farmland and immigration status, which is kind of random and esoteric. But I know there are examples because Mr. Anderson and I have talked about them, and I don't remember what they are, but he can tell you.
Well, and certainly in terms of an affordability requirement along the lines of what's in there and restrictions on the use of it, there are other examples in terms of programs that the state operates, the Manufactured Housing Community Redevelopment Program that provides grants to help with infrastructure, require 25 years of affordability, and if there's a sale during that 25-year period, then they have to consult with Minnesota Housing about the nature of the intended buyer and whether that would result in a potential change in use. So it seems so there are some examples that we can think of in terms of and I think the those provisions having to do with that particular program, I think they're similar to other provisions related to other grant programs the state may have related to affordable housing. But I know that's a fairly general response.
Thank you, Chair Stevens. This just seems a little bit new for Minnesota. I just ask that we tread lightly on this and make sure that we've got the right language in this, because there's a lot of, if it's not done right, we can have a lot of more repercussions in the future if we move forward too quickly on this. So thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the same language that's being discussed, I guess I'd like to know a little bit about you know, some what-if scenarios on here, because I don't see any other statutory references in here, and so I'm just kind of wanting to get some belt and suspenders, since I do have three manufactured home parks that are in my district, and some of them have had some challenges with residents wanting to purchase and some clarity on language and things. So my first question, Mr. Chair, and can either be to the bill author or to the testifier, can the residents who purchase the property decertify the 10-year period of time if they collectively choose to sell to an outside party?
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's kind of the same question as Representative Farr had. You know, the remedies section of this bill does not relate to that specific scenario, so there is no enforcement of that rule. I would be happy to like add some clarifying language about like how that scenario would play out, but it's definitely not something that we specified within the bill language as it stands.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other part of this is I know that we can also have eminent domain proceedings that are associated with this, because that has happened in some neighboring districts and communities to where I live, and wanting to know how eminent domain would deal with this. And you might want to look at notwithstanding eminent domain proceedings by a county or a city or other government entity on here. Because again, the language is pretty tight, saying that it's got to be certified and used for 10 years. I just don't want to get into a situation where there may be a greater use or purpose for it that benefits the community, and they're hamstrung by not being able to do it because of the covenant of the 10-year ownership.
Representative Feist.
Yes, Mr. Anderson just informed me that that exact language is already in Minnesota state law in the context of the right of first refusal. So that language does appear elsewhere, but I'd be happy to take a look at it and see if there is any clarifying language we want. I mean, we do ultimately want to encourage the residents to operate the manufactured housing community as such for 10 years. Like, that is the goal. There are a lot of outside pressures, commercial pressures, community pressures sometimes to transform those communities into other uses. And the goal here is to encourage this really important, accessible form of affordable housing in all areas. But I'm happy to take a look at that language.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, the final question on here, and Representative Feist, thank you for looking at that, and I'm familiar with one particular manufactured home park that's in the central Minnesota area that was purchased, and because there was government financing in there to be able to do some things for economic development, that required purchasing leases and different things of the residents in there under Minnesota law for relocation and the like. I'm just kind of wanting to, again, get clarity on this, if they themselves are looking to sell as a part of a cooperation with a government entity to use that property or purpose that property for road or other housing or different kinds of things, just really on a local basis makes sense. What happens in that situation? I just want them to be able to have a clear glide path in order to be able to enter into negotiations if it is in fact in the best interest of the individuals in that particular manufactured park community.
Thank you. I mean, I think we would like to discourage them from transferring or transitioning from a community to a road in this bill, but I'm happy again to like look at the language, make sure that it's clear, make sure that the expectations are clear, and if they are not met, you know, what repercussions, if any, there are. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll. With that, I'll turn over to Representative Feist for closing comments, but before I do that, I just want to congratulate you for your work on this bill. This bill has been incredibly contentious in past years. Members who are returning might recall that our hearing on this similar legislation a couple years ago was so contentious that I think it spilled over into a floor fight on the adoption of the committee report. And so it is, I think, really impressive that you were able to bring the stakeholders together and achieve a compromise solution. So congratulations, and thank you also to the stakeholders for working hard to achieve that. And with that, closing comments, Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the kind words. And I would just in turn like to thank the stakeholders for working so hard on a really complex bill structure and with really high stakes for everyone. So thank you, everyone. I will say that this definitely isn't happening too quickly. This bill's been around for a really long time. Conversations have been going on for a really long time, and just the amount of time that everyone has spent in the last week talking about it and thinking about it deeply, I think, is really impressive. And I guess just in closing, you know, manufactured housing communities are unique in that people own their homes, but they do not own the land beneath their homes. And so they're uniquely vulnerable. And so, you know, providing this like unique vehicle to give them that opportunity to have that power over the land beneath their homes, I think is really valuable. And it's valuable to like all of our communities across the state of Minnesota. So thank you all for hearing this bill today.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 817 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 817 as amended is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Feist.
Thank you.
Before we move to the next bill on the agenda, but I will ask maybe Representative Elkins, if he's in the room. I saw him a second. There he is. Come down. But while he's doing that, we're going to take up the minutes really quick. Representative Katizawatoon, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 7th minutes.
Representative Katizawatoon moves approval of the minutes for March 7th, 2023. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes for March 7th, 2023 are approved. We will next move to House File 295 from Representative Elkins. I will move House File 295 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Elkins, you have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment, which is an amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it. Anything you'd like to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so the author's amendment, we received a lot of feedback after the bill was heard in the Labor and Industry Committee. And so the main things that the author's amendment does is it removes the so-called garden leave provision, which nobody liked. And it's much more explicit now in terms of items that the that are not covered by non-compete agreements, including things like the bill with this amendment now makes it clear that it does not cover non-solicit agreements, non-disclosure agreements. All of those things are clearly allowable even if under this bill. And the other main change that it makes is that it only makes the bill applicable to workers who basically have below median incomes as well. So it does not apply to highly paid executives or professional workers.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Yep. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the In recent years, there's been a proliferation of these non-compete agreements. Basically, they limit where an employee can move to in terms of their next job, either geographically or within an industry. And in many cases, they are being used in place of, for example, a non-disclosure agreement or a non-solicitation agreement, which would be more appropriate to protect intellectual property or protect a client list, simply because they're easier to enforce. And as a consequence, it restricts mobility in the labor market. It weakens the ability of employees to bargain for the wages that they ought to be entitled to the point where they've become, you know, so prevalent that they're having a noticeable impact on economic efficiency. I look at my own career. I'm an economist by education. I worked for a series of five different major airlines in their pricing departments. I went from TWA, where I worked my way through college as a baggage handler, to Continental, to Western, to Republic and Northwest. I would never have been allowed to pursue that kind of a career path in today's market, because each one of those airlines would have had a non-compete agreement that says you can't go to work for another airline. it's personal in some respects as well, in that my younger daughter a couple of years ago was offered a new job with a new company with a substantial increase in compensation, but on the day she arrived to fill out her employment paperwork, they put a non-disclosure agreement under her nose. She refused to sign it and then spent the next 3 months finding her next job. Provisions for non-solicitation agreements for salespeople, non-disclosure, people who possess trade secret knowledge are protected here. There's no reason for the overuse of non-compete agreements in this way. Thank you.
Okay. We'll move now to testimony. We have Gavin Hansen. Come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gavin Hansen, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership, which represents many of Minnesota's largest employers. I would first like to thank both the author, Representative Elkins, and the Chair of the committee, Representative Stevens, for taking the time to meet and discuss our concerns with House File 295, a bill dealing with non-competes. The Business Partnership is grateful for the author's amendment, which addresses some of those concerns with the bill. Minnesota is home to a diverse economy with many innovative businesses, from manufacturing of optic and medical devices to machinery, electrical equipment, ATV vehicles, and aircraft. We are a nation leader in ingenuity. This economic diversity is what makes Minnesota's economy unique amongst its peers. Ensuring the ideas that make our businesses unique also remain secure is vital. Businesses use non-compete agreements to protect the company's intellectual property, confidential and trade secret information, investments in developing customer goodwill, and other legitimate business and proprietary interests. As such, the Minnesota Business Partnership does not support overburdensome mandates on those agreements. They impact the Minnesota business's competitiveness and threaten our economic vitality. Thank you again for the opportunity to share our concerns with the committee.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, Representative Elkins, I'm trying to get through the amendment. I have not gotten through it all the way. But what you said may have influenced my question. I was looking at lines 2.3 to 2.6. about this four-person, the median family income for a four-person family in Minnesota. And frankly, I was trying to Google and just find that information. And it's relatively difficult to find. I'm wondering, this is not language I've seen in other bills, this mm-hmm. Census Bureau data. How did you come up with that metric for this?
Representative Elkins.
Representative Newbrinley, it came in the bill. I kind of inherited it from Representative Schultz last year when she retired. I picked it up. So basically, it's just a way of measuring to limiting it to people who are below average income. But I found when I Googled it, I found that it's currently around $77,000.
Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't identify family of four, which was tricky. I don't know. Maybe it is easier to find than I thought. But I mm-hmm. just Googling, it was an odd number. But it sounds like you don't necessarily know why we picked that number either. That's inherited.
I think we're just looking for a benchmark that we can use to say people. It's only going to apply to people who are below average wealth.
People who are, thank you, Mr. Chair, people who are below average.
Income. Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Good clarification.
Yeah. Okay.
So the bill creates an individual benefit, for lack of a better word, but it is based on the income for a family of four. Why did you choose to base the income on a family of four when it's an individual benefit?
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newbrinley, it's no particular reason. We're looking for household income. Nothing particularly magic about it.
Okay.
Representative Bridlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your honesty, Representative Elkins. It seems like maybe we should maybe think more thoroughly about that and with some intention on what we're doing with this. I have some concerns. I guess on lines 2.7 to 2.10, my question is, what happens if an employee leaves voluntarily?
Representative Elkins. I think it looks like, I'm sorry, Representative New Brindley, that language was deleted in the A2 yep. amendment. It's line 2.5, delete page 2, lines 1 to 10.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so actually that language was deleted as well.
But I see that the language about the...
is still the same.
And the family income is yep. inserted above that.
It's still the same language.
The part that you were just referencing, though, is gone and not returned.
Perfect.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for pointing that out. And I think that's a good thing. That didn't make much sense to me. My last comment is, you know, you said that it's easier to enforce a non-disclosure than a non-compete. And I just want to give an example of where, as I was looking through this bill, what quickly came to my mind is a non-disclosure bill implies that you are disclosing information or secrets, whatever it may be, proprietary information. The problem is knowledge is information, and you can't separate knowledge from an individual. And what you know is going to influence how you behave. Mm-hmm. It is really difficult to separate yourself from that information. So if you are working for one company, you choose to leave and go to another company, you may not technically disclose information to the new company, to your employers, but the information that you own, because it's yours, it's in your own head, mm-hmm. you can't separate yourself from that, which I think is ultimately why we have these non-competes, and frankly, why people choose to sign these non-competes. Like this, the idea that somehow people are coerced. I mean, I'm sorry that it took your daughter time to find a new job, but she was not forced to sign a non-compete. You can choose to find employment elsewhere, especially in this job market. My goodness, we know, we've got very low unemployment and a very high labor participation rate. Finding workers is the real problem right now, finding folks to come. But my concern is, like I said, the non-compete ensures that proprietary information can't be shared inadvertently. It ensures that an individual, when you own that knowledge, because it's in your head, you're not going to share that with another company inadvertently through your own work product. It ensures that information stays with the individual and with the company. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Elkins, we have a couple of people on the list, but I'll give you a chance to briefly respond.
Just briefly respond to that. I think that this provision will probably continue to evolve. This morning I addressed the American Council of Engineering Companies and talked to a whole group of civil engineers who basically have their core knowledge is stuff that they received as part of their education, and bring that to the job. And their group, physicians is another group that I think still needs to be addressed as well. These are very highly educated people. They're well paid people. But the knowledge that they bring to the job and they take from job to job to job, it really isn't trade secret, and there isn't any reason why people in those professions should be, bound, by a non-compete agreement when anything that they do happen to have, that's proprietary, would be covered under a non-disclosure agreement. I worked in information technology for the last 25 years of my career. And, I've signed dozens of non-disclosure agreements. There are a couple of things that are very proprietary that are still locked in my head, and it will remain secrets that I will take to my grave. But just moving, taking the things that I've learned as part of my career development from company to company doesn't violate anybody's intellectual property.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for bringing this. I just want to make a quick comment that was kind of prompted to me by one of the testifiers, you know, who called this an, or was talking about overburdensome mandates on business. If there was ever an overburdensome mandate, it is non-compete agreements on employees. So there's a just tremendous irony in that statement. And, you know, this is the talking about what knowledge, taking your knowledge to another company. Knowledge is what people sell as employees. And if I was going to make the whole decision here, I would just get rid of them altogether. I don't think it should be limited to just people who are lower income. But anyway, I just wanted to thank you for carrying this and just to say I fully support this, what you're doing here.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Elkins, thank you for bringing this bill. I just want to speak up for the professionals that live in my community of Plymouth and Medicine Lake. They are disappointed that this bill will not incorporate many of the positions that they have based on family income. They would like to see this broadened and be more inclusive. They feel as though their human rights are actually violated by these non-compete clauses, and that they feel that they are restricted in that they may be, their pay increases are sometimes limited mm-hmm. because they know, their employers know yep. they can get away with not paying them more because their hands are tied and they can't go into other competitive positions. I'd like to speak to the moment, or the comment about just in general, not mm-hmm. to any representative's comment, but just to the statement of owning knowledge. Everybody knows when they work in these capacities what knowledge and is theirs and what information belongs to their employers. There is no gray space here. Furthermore, when an employee moves to a new company, the new company has a vested interest in making sure that that new employee does not bring information, proprietary information that belongs to the previous employer. No one wants their products tied up in lawsuits and lengthy litigation. Everybody wants to make sure that the knowledge, that the information, and I think that's the difference, knowledge and information are two different things. The information that belongs to the previous employer is theirs and theirs alone. Mm-hmm. Knowledge and wisdom that you gain from an employment is very different from information that belongs to someone else. So thank you very much for bringing this. I encourage you to expand the scope.
And Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions, and then maybe a follow-up. Representative Elkins, when we're calculating the salary and income on this, are we using deeds numbers for unemployment or worker comp, or what are we using for the numbers to be able to calculate? I just want to kind of go back to a little bit of what Representative Newport-Lean was talking about, trying to focus in on that number.
Representative O'Driscoll, these are numbers that are compiled by the Census Bureau and probably also available through the, another federal agency that does employment data.
Yeah, but in the bill, the amendment says it's the Census Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
Representative O'Driscoll, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Elkins, I want to ask you a question. I'm just going to give you a little story. You and I have become business partners, and we have started a small real estate company. I'll use real estate mm-hmm. because that's within the jurisdiction of this committee. And we've done a pretty good job, and we're located in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Yeah.
And now another company would like to come in and buy us out. My question is this. If you and I are principals or equity holders in this, are we covered or not covered by an agreement to buy our business, since we are employees and principals of the organization? How would we be affected by that? And the reason I ask that question is that could affect what you and I could get for the business, because mm-hmm. if we could go across the street, put our shingle out again, and compete against the people who are purchasing our business, that's going to dramatically affect our value that we can get in the marketplace. And you and I might be just about ready to get retired and move on, and that could really impede our ability for the work that we've done to be able to enjoy a retirement at some point, because we just don't have a buyer because of the potential implications of this law.
Representative Elkins, what's your thoughts on this wonderful odd couple hypothetical that we have going on here?
I'm bipartisan, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
no, Representative O'Driscoll and I get along very well. We're on property taxes together this year.
Good.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
So I think your concern is addressed on if you look at the amendment on line 1.13.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just finishing reading this. So acquiring or disposing of ownership interest. So there is no income limit on this, and these individuals will be excluded?
Representative Elkins.
This language is, yes, it's across the board. So there's not an income. I don't think I'm reading it that way.
I think that's right, Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Because you're excluding it from the definition of a covenant.
Yes.
Complete altogether. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, run that by me again. I wasn't following you there.
The what happens on line 1.13 is an agreement entered into by a person purchasing or selling the goodwill of a business enterprise, so on and so forth, that's excluded from covenant not to compete up on line 1.4. And since the bill says covenants not to compete void and unenforceable on 1.19 of the, it's just a straight exclusion.
Mr. Chair, yeah, now I'm tracking because there was a lot of different things that were moving parts in here. I'm trying to take the DE against the bill and trying to figure that out. And I think that's important because we've got a lot of small business owners out there who that is their retirement, and I don't want to put them in a difficult spot.
Yeah.
My business partner, Representative Elkins, and I have worked very hard to establish the success of this business, and we want to be able to retire, and we want to have a market in which to be able to sell that business.
Half a question, half a business proposition. Representative Elkins, very brief closing comments.
No, this bill has one more stop. I'm still open to continuing feedback. I do want to somehow address this situation with professional workers as part of that. My Senate author is a physician, and she feels very strongly about that issue as well. So that will be one issue that we will continue to work on.
All right, and with that, I will renew my motion that House File 295 be recommended as amended. House File 295 as amended be recommended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 295 as amended is recommended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The next item on our agenda is House File 2084 from Representative Hemmingson Yeager. And while the good representative makes her way down, I will move House File 2084 be recommended be placed on the general register. And there is also a DE2 amendment, which I assume is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that the committee would like, the author would like the committee to consider it. Is that correct, Representative Hemmingson Yeager?
That is correct, yes, please.
Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? All right, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hemmingson Yeager, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and members, for having me here today to talk about homeowners associations. So I live in Woodbury, and homeowners associations are very prevalent in our community. For this bill, first I'd like to thank the Community Association Institute as well as the Minnesota State Bar Association for working with us on this bill. We have adopted in the DE a number of the technical edits from the State Bar Association. I would also like to thank the Homeownership Center and Legal Aid, who see clients all the time who are facing foreclosure on a lien based on fines, assessments, and attorney fee liens. In these cases, however, the attorney fees are very wildly disproportionate to the underlying amount that's actually owed by the homeowner. For example, in my own community, there's a Washington County homeowner who owed $1,800. We're working to pay it back, but then had $19,000 of attorney's fees tacked on, and basically she couldn't save her home because of that. So this is really to protect owners. We want to make sure that homeowners are not losing their homes because of unpaid attorney's fees, but based on the fines and assessments that was originally assessed for. And I would like to make sure that I do have phone a friend from Legal Aid to address any technical questions, and I would like to give some time to my testifier to tell her story as well.
All right. Well, we will move to testimony, and it looks like Dina Sambal maybe is on the list. So, Ms. Sambal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dina Sambal, and I'm here to tell my story. I've owned a townhouse for nearly 10 years, and during all those years, I paid my dues timely, without incident, through auto pay from my bank account. In September of 2021, My association switched management companies, and I was not made aware of this, and my automatic payments stopped. It wasn't until 6 months later that I happened to visit my parents' house and find a letter that informed me and asked me to pay, that informed me that I was 6 months past due. I owed about $1,700. I called in that day to the management company and apologized for missing the switch that I was not informed of and asked to pay my balance in full and place my account back on auto pay. The lady at the management company told me she'd send me a form that I would provide my bank account number, my routing number, my authorization, and my signature to take out the full balance and place me on auto pay. I did that. I got a response saying that my request had been received. They then proceeded to take out the monthly dues for 6 months, and then in August of 2022, my tenant got served with foreclosure papers. I was shocked. I submitted payment. I got confirmation. They've been taking payments for the last 6 months. Surely this was some kind of big misunderstanding. I contacted the attorney and explained to him what had happened. At this point, I needed to pay not $1,700, but $8,184.26 immediately, or my house would be sold at the sheriff's sale in October. I explained to the attorney what happened, and he said that people lie when they're desperate and they're about to lose their home. I told him that I was not lying and that I would forward proof, which I did. A few hours later, he wrote me back and said that it was still my fault and that I had to pay his attorney's fees or I would lose my home at the foreclosure sale in October. After seeking my own legal counsel, I learned that what my HOA and the management company had done, making a mistake and then handing my file over to an attorney to bill up fees, is completely legal under the law, and that I had no choice but to pay or lose my house at the sheriff's sale. So I paid. And then I was charged an additional $2,593 in more attorney's fees after I had already paid that money to get my house out of foreclosure for asking questions of the lawyer and trying to show him that I had paid my past due amount and that this was a mistake. For every minute the lawyer spent reading my email and pleading my case, he charged me handsomely. In total, this ordeal cost me $11,000 when I owed $1,700 and submitted full payment. Of that $11,000, $8,000 went into the attorney's pocket. So the management company and the HOA made a mistake and without my knowledge or consent handed me over to an attorney who was allowed to exploit me for an exorbitant amount of fees that went higher and higher the more I tried to plead my case or simply ask questions to try and understand. I filed a complaint with the Minnesota Attorney General. My caseworker said he could send a letter, but that I needed to understand that the attorney would charge me to respond to the Minnesota Attorney General and that the Minnesota Attorney General couldn't do anything anyway because everything that had happened was legal. Of course, all the attorney's fees were paid by the HOA because the HOA has no interest to check that the fees billed are reasonable as required under the law because they don't foot the bill. The homeowner does. And the person who foots the bill is not even allowed to ask questions. And this happened to me, and I'm a dean and law professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. I said to the lawyer, you saw I submitted payment. You saw I was on auto pay. Why didn't you put my name in Google and the first entry would be Dean Assemble, Dean of Academic Excellence at Mitchell Hamlin, with my email and phone number? His response, the law does not require me to find you. And he sure didn't want to find me, because as long as he didn't find me, he could keep billing his fees and eventually take my house. Thankfully, I was able to save my home because I was able to come up with thousands of dollars on the spot. But other people are not so lucky, and they lose their home and the equity that they've worked so hard to build over uncapped and unchecked attorney's fees. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with the committee. We really appreciate it. Next, I think we have Mr. Elwood. Do you intend to testify here or just available for questions? Okay. Next, we have Patrick Hines. Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Patrick Hines with Messerly and Kramer. I'm here on behalf of the Community Associations Institute, the Minnesota chapter, which represents the interests of homeowner associations in Minnesota, including its residents, volunteer board members, and the businesses that serve those associations. I want to thank Representative Hemmingson-Yeager for working collaboratively on this bill and also legal aid in the Homeownership Center. We've spent a great deal of time working on the language and the DE2 amendment. In front of you, I would just like to say that CAI supports all of the provisions at this point except for the language on line on page 12, the new language. That is the language that relates to attorney fees and foreclosure. I don't think we're still working on language that we hopefully can agree to. I think the problem that we're trying to deal with is dealing with the extreme cases like we just heard, which I think is very unfortunate, and I question the actions of the attorney in that matter. But adjusting the law that deals with every single foreclosure that might arise under different circumstances is difficult, but we're committed to working with Representative Hemmingson Yeager on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jennifer DeJournette.
Chair Stevenson and members, my name is Jennifer DeJournette, and my family lives in a single-family homeowners association. Today, I'm speaking in support of House File 2084. Nationally, HOAs collect $103.2 billion per year from homeowners. Nationwide, there's 25.1 million homes and 68 million residents in HOAs. In Minnesota, 26.7% of all homeowners live in HOAs. Approximately 80% of new construction finds its way into an HOA, and approximately 1.5 2 million Minnesotans live in an HOA, adding millions of dollars per year in mandatory dues, not even including the actual housing stock costs. It's no secret that homeowners associations have become troublesome, and there's no oversight of them. The insurance industry is less willing to underwrite insurance for homeowners associations because they are considered high-risk clients. HOAs are typically run by residents with no experience or training. Documents are not written in plain language and are confusing. There are no requirements for HOAs to be managed by professional management companies, and actually most are not, actually. There are no licensure or training requirements. When there is no oversight of these bodies and no accountability, things go badly. My HOA stopped having elections, which is obviously very important to me because I've devoted the last 20 years of my life to that. Did not have open board meetings, lacked transparency, and the records were carelessly maintained, if at all, and there were no conflict of interest policies. I had concerns about the lack of regular elections, operations, and accounting practices. I made the unfortunate mistake of putting my dues in personal escrow, always intending to pay, but wanted to meet with the board to discuss my concerns and have them corrected. In October of 2019, thousands of dollars were demanded from our family, and in order to protect our home, we paid $4,000 to remove the lien that was placed on our home. It did not matter that we timely disputed the amounts or that the HOA would not explain any basis for the charges, refused to meet with us or grant us a hearing. Our choice was to pay or put our home at risk. My husband and I immediately brought litigation against the association in district court and a second action in conciliation court as pro se litigants. The HOA had two law firms, five lawyers, numerous paralegals and numerous legal assistants, an infinite amount of insurance money, and their ability to levy against all homeowners to fight us. As pro se litigants, we discovered through subpoenas and the depositions we conducted that we were charged usury level interest rates, a different homeowner's charge was placed on our home, and other non-related items were placed on our account without explanation, and still to this day, 4 years later, we still do not have the complete financial record related to our property. We eventually settled with the association in both matters. The HOA paid us almost four times the amount that they forced us to pay, and they paid all the mediation costs and agreed to long-term operational changes. Minnesota needs to join states like Texas, Colorado, Florida, California, and other states that have been reformed and have modernized this section of law to provide basic level protections for homeowners and those who would not be able to do what we did. Get our money back and protect our neighbors. I support House File 2084, but it needs to be amended to include fines as part of the reinstatement section because HOAs will shift to a heavy fine model to skirt H24 changes, and all the work being done in this bill will be quickly undone. And nobody speaks for homeowners like me because we do not qualify for legal aid and we are on our own. No one should lose their home because a trash can is left out, or if they're a multi-generational family that left an extra car in their driveway, or bias rules and some sort of modern-day redlining action. As my husband letter, As my husband letter notes, our HOA recently added a fine against speech. No one should lose their home because they spoke up in a meeting against a policy they disagreed with, or if they feel their rights were violated or were a whistleblower like me. One last point, and the scariest part of HOAs in this section of law, which most people who have who live in them don't even know, is that you can be current in your property taxes, you can be current in your mortgage, and the HOA can take your home from you if you are late in your dues or fines, even if it is just one single penny. That is the power this very outdated section of law has bestowed upon HOAs with no oversight and no accountability. Tremendous power and no check and balance. So I encourage you to pass this bill, even if it doesn't have the amendment, but please amend it to include the fines, and then come back in a future session and join the other states that have reformed this section of law to provide basic protections for the 1.52 million homeowners and HOAs across this great state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
We will now move to member discussion to the bill. Thank you for your testimony. Discussion to the bill. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Someone who is very, very familiar with Statute 515B, the Minnesota CIC, Commonwealth Community Law, since June 1st of 1994, because that's the day that Minnesota adopted and put into law this provision. And over the years, the legislature has refined that process. I just want to give members a little bit of background, and I do have empathy for what the two testifiers are going through. But when you purchase a property that's covered by a CIC in the state of Minnesota, you're given extra benefits, privileges, and rights to exit your purchase agreement and your agreement to purchase these types of properties. One of the things that's mandated by Minnesota law, by the time you sign a purchase agreement, within 10, you are to be provided within a reasonable period of time, your documents that are your declaration, your bylaws, your rules, your regulations about conduct, your fees, copies of the budget, so you can review those. You have 10 days from the receipt of those, not from the day you signed the purchase agreement, from the date of receipt of these documents, which in some cases could be 35 and 40 days into the agreement, because they have to be generated and be current documents that are brought forward to individuals to be able to look at. And the homeowner has to pay, who's selling their unit, they have to pay to update this information to get it in a timely fashion. As a matter of fact, we have a provision in law that says it can't be more than 90 days out of date. The reason I bring that forward is we're in a situation where the folks who are on these HOA boards are owners of properties who step up on a volunteer basis, much like the legislature and everybody around this table, who are citizen legislators. These are citizen homeowners who are stepping up to volunteer to manage on behalf of the association. They're the ones who take the calls at night. They're the ones who take the calls from folks who go on page such and such in our handbook and in our rules, who's going to enforce this. And it's usually the president, who is again an owner of property in there. HOAs have a very difficult time of finding people to run for the boards for these very reasons. No one wants to take on this. And as we talk about affordable housing, this is a way to make housing affordable, because you can put a higher density on a smaller parcel of property. We're going to have more, not less, of these types of things. So individuals who are interested in purchasing the property know what the rules are. Do you know what the experience on this is? Many people take the sheet, says, I've seen this. They don't read the documents until they have an issue. I'm not making or passing judgment or comment on anyone's ability or their willingness to read or whether they did or didn't. I'm just explaining to you, we have a number of rules in place. And at any time, in that 10-day period of time, an individual can decide to void their contract, get their earnest money back, and go out and look at another property if they so desire. So I wanted to put balance on this, that there are laws out there and that these are run by volunteers. One of the testifiers mentioned that in this situation, we also have folks who will step up, and there's a management company that's involved. And the reason there's a management company involved is the people on the board don't have the expertise, or perhaps the time and expertise, to be able to work through those issues. And so they hire professional management companies to help with those and help with the budgeting and to be able to comply with the law. So again, I just wanted to bring another perspective to this, or help finish the circle of what we're hearing on this. And I'm not saying that that's a reason to vote for or against the bill. I felt it's important that because of 515B and the work that has been done on that bill and on that legislation over the years to try to make it more consumer friendly, that this committee should have the benefit of that information. And again, I probably have taught for 30 years quite a number of people who are licensed in the state of Minnesota to sell real estate those provisions in the law that I've just outlined for the committee here today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you. If I could just kind of respond, Representative O'Driscoll, thank you very much for all of your insight and wisdom and expertise. In my experience, it's really hard to find a house or a neighborhood in Woodbury that does not have an HOA. So, you know, that limits your choice when you're trying to find a house. And we wanted to move into Woodbury because the schools and the parks and trails, it was close to downtown St. Paul. It was really hard to find a house that was not in an HOA. We requested to look at the bylaws and everything ahead of time so we could be more informed and knew what we were getting into. It was so hard for our agent to get those from our association. And we don't have any communal, like we don't have a pool, we don't have a community space. Like there are some HOAs that offer that in Woodbury. We don't have that. So it was really, really challenging for us. So that's kind of where my experience is. As far as the bill is concerned, this is really just focusing on that HOA and homeowner relationship when it comes to the fines and the assessments that are in those bylaws that are out there. This is just meant to address those attorney fees that stack up and make sure that people don't lose their home because they can't pay compounding and expanding attorney's fees. There is still a mechanism to pay those, but a person can still keep their home as long as they pay the fine for which they were addressed. So I just want to make sure we're kind of on the narrow scope that is this bill. But I will, and to Mr. Hines, and we continue to work on language to make sure that we all have agreements, and I'm a hard worker and will continue to engage in conversation. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2084, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. House File 2084, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Next item on our agenda is House File 1804 from Vice Chair Katiza Watoon. Representative Katiza Watoon, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1804 to be before the committee.
Representative Katiza Watoon moves House File 1804 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And then there is a DE3 amendment. Do you want to move and describe the DE?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm going to move the DE2 amendment. It significantly shortens the language of the bill. We, you know, put forward a number of proposals and suggestions in one package, and have decided to move forward on just two sections of the original bill. So that's what you will find in the DE2.
Any discussion to the DE2? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE2 is adopted. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, I would like to thank Mr. Elwood and the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association for working collaboratively on this bill. And as I mentioned, the DE does represent the product of these discussions thus far. So the DE does two things. It provides for disclosure for car buyers that the vehicle that they have purchased has what is called a kill switch. And number two, it expands the number of vehicles that are required to have a warranty upon purchase. Some dealers who finance the purchase of vehicles install GPS starter interrupt devices or kill switches. These devices allow a dealer to remotely disable a vehicle. Oftentimes, a buyer is unaware that these kill switches have been installed on their vehicle, and you can imagine the driver's surprise when a car is suddenly disabled by someone in a different location flipping a switch. House File 1804, as amended, would require the dealer to tell the buyer that the car has one of these devices. And as you will hear, the Automobile Dealers Association would like to continue discussions on the precise language, and of course, we will continue working. That's one of the reasons why the bill is being laid over today. The second part of the bill increases consumer protection regarding warranties. Under current Minnesota law, there is no requirement that cars sold that have more than 75,000 miles have any warranty at all. House File 1804 would require dealers who exclusively sell used cars to warrant that the cars they sell are fit for the use for which they are intended. The warranty requirement in the bill provides a basic warranty for a limited period of time for those higher mileage vehicles. With that, I would like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Todd Murray, an attorney who has experience representing consumers who have been harmed by this gap in consumer protection regarding warranties that this bill seeks to fill.
Mr. Murray, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Todd Murray. I'm a private consumer rights attorney practicing at the law firm of Friedman Murray in Minneapolis. Since 2010, I've represented many consumers who have purchased used vehicles only to have problems crop up after the purchase. These problems are often significant mechanical issues that necessitate expensive repairs or even more serious issues that render the vehicle unsafe to drive for both the buyer and their families. This bill just seeks to extend the already existing warranty protections in Minnesota law for vehicles under 75,000 miles to vehicles over 75,000 miles. The warranty that is in the bill is very modest. It is 15 days or 500 miles. That's a very low bar to clear to sell a used vehicle that will not have any mechanical problems for 15 days. And I think that over the last 12 years in practice, I've represented dozens of consumers in litigation. I've talked to nearly 1,000 consumers that I haven't been able to help, and I think this bill will go a long ways to closing a loophole in the law. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have Amber Backus. Ms. Backus, if you want to make your way down, state your name for record, proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association and our 375 franchise new car and truck dealers located in communities across the state of Minnesota. We truly appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill, and we thank Mr. Elwood for reaching out before it was even introduced to talk about some of the issues they wanted to address and work to find compromise. And as you heard the language before you in sections 4 and 5, establishing a new class of warranties for vehicles with over 75,000 miles addresses a specific problem in a targeted fashion without disrupting the market by devaluing consumer trade-ins brought to franchise dealers or taking high mileage vehicles in good conditions out of the Minnesota marketplace. And as Representative Katiza Watun alluded to with regard to the kill switch provision, we agree with the intent. There should be disclosure if a dealer installs a device to immobilize a vehicle remotely, but we do want to work on that definition of kill switch as the language in the bill is fairly broad and could cover things like OnStar or insurer provided telematics. But we look forward to continuing the conversation, and it's been a great process so far, and thank you very much for your time.
Any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your consideration of House File 1804. I think that this is a relatively simple bill. Really difficult, I think, for consumers who might find themselves in need of looking for a car. The market is tight these days. There's been supply chain issues with new vehicles, lots more used vehicles on the market these days. The cost has kind of gone up. So for folks who are looking for a car that is in this high mile range, and they go into the sale expecting that the car is going to work for them, and the issues that they are having in transportation, they should be able to assume that that car is actually going to do that and function as a reliable vehicle. So I appreciate it, and we will certainly continue the conversations on the kill switch portion of the vehicle, but I appreciate the support.
Wonderful. And with that, the bill is laid over. And now Representative Katiza Watun and I need to switch places.
Members, the next bill on the agenda for the day is House File 2300. Mr. Chair, when you are ready, please go ahead and move your bill.
Madam Chair, I would move House File 2300 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Stevenson moves that House File 2300 be laid over for possible inclusion in a committee omnibus bill. Looks like we do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment getting the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it.
Right. Members, any discussion regarding the A2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that Mr. Chair would like? Seeing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted, Mr. Chair, to House File 2300 as amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 2300 is a proposal brought forth by the Department of Commerce, and so I'm going to let the department take the bulk of the explanation of the bill, except to say that, you know, we, at the beginning of this year, we had a great discussion about the insurance industry in Minnesota and discussed the amazing toll that our changing climate is having on homeowners and homeowners premiums in Minnesota by function of more and more extreme weather events. And I think House File 2300 is an important and innovative way that the department is responding to that reality. And with that, I think Mr. Brickwitty will do a much better job of explaining what's in the bill than I could.
Assistant Commissioner Brickwitty can introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Mr. Chair, I think you did a wonderful job introducing it. I just have a couple of quick slides that I want to try to show if I can make them work. Let's see if it will happen.
It went black.
Oh,
there we go.
Oh. Madam Chair, the issue... So much easier to do it from home, from your own desk.
Well, that's a first.
Madam Chair, this is an item that is in the Commerce Department's budget and was included in the governor's budget this year. What we have before you today is the policy language that is associated with a new program for that has a fiscal impact. So I think members have the change page from the Commerce Department budget dealing with the financial portions, but the language for you before you today is the policy language, which we had broken off into a separate standalone bill so it could be considered both here and in the climate and energy committees in both bodies, because it has an impact on both jurisdictions, because it really is a cross-functional proposal spanning the breadth of the entire department, which overlays both budget areas. The proposal is a fairly simple one. We're creating a grant program to provide financial assistance to Minnesotans to strengthen their roofs and siding to a standard developed by an organization called the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. Folks from that organization were here last week talking about the science that they do at their research institution in South Carolina, where they study and test extreme weather events against building materials. And they have developed a standard called Fortified, which is a technical standard that secures roofs in a way that prevents water intrusion and limits damage from wind and high wind events and hail. And our purpose in bringing this proposal forward is because, as we've heard in committee previously, our property and casualty market in Minnesota is tightening, and we're seeing that across the country. Consumers in Minnesota are experiencing more frequent and more costly storms. And the slide that I really wanted to show you was from the National Oceanic Administration, or NOAA, and they have tracking of insurance costs per year by state. And last year was our most expensive year from an insurance perspective due to the storms that passed through the state. And if you just don't want to cherry pick one year, the other thing that's noticeable about that graph is that our costs in Minnesota tend to go up irregularly, not just seasonally, due to the nature of our weather, which is extreme relative to the rest of the country. If you were to compare our weather to another state, say Alabama, which is where we are basing this proposal on an existing program in that state, typically their costs go up during hurricane season, but only in that season. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions. I know we're sort of coming up on time. The amendment, which Ms. Pompeo helped us draft, helps to just clarify the responsibilities of the insurers and consolidates what had previously been three sections of the bill into a tighter three or four subdivisions. We are coupling the grant proposal, which is the bulk of the financial impact, with a requirement that insurers offer mandatory premium discounts to their policyholders who put a fortified roof on their home. That's because there is a corresponding actuarially justified premium reduction in the insurance risk that that is realized and for the insurance company, we think should be enjoyed also by the policyholder. So happy to stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Workmitty. And perhaps you could send us the slides just so that we have that graph for reference.
Try not to knock over anything else.
Oh, they already are posted on the website, so in case members want to pull that up for the public. All right. Next, we have Aaron Cocking with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Cocking with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today on Chair Stevenson's resiliency bill. As many of you are aware, and I think some of you even had the chance to see, the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, the IABHS, presented to Representative Acomb's Energy Committee last week about the benefits of building homes to a fortified standard. These fortified homes are able to withstand wind and hail damage at a far greater degree than current homes are built to, and more specifically to what our building codes even require. Our industry has always been fully supportive of not only the IABHS in the work that they do, but also to building codes and building Minnesota buildings to a higher standard. And we support the fortified standard because when hit by a severe storm, they are more likely to withstand the effects of that storm. I have been before this committee previously talking about the impacts of the climate crisis and the impact that our extreme weather has on Minnesota policyholders in the form of premium and on insurers on the losses that they pay out. There's no reason that we're going to expect to see subsiding in severe weather anytime soon. And so we need to find additional ways to better fortify Minnesota homes so that the cost associated with those storms is significantly blunted. We do have some concerns with Chair Stevenson's bill as it currently is written, most notably because of the mandated premium discounts included in the bill. As a matter of principle, the Insurance Federation of Minnesota is opposed to mandated premium discounts required by the state. We fully believe that insurers price according to risk. And as the IIBHS presentation demonstrated, these homes are able to withstand much greater weather forces and are a much better insurance risk. As a result, companies will be actively pursuing this business because of the quality of the risk that exists. And that better risk is reflected in lower premium without a requirement from the state. Now, I understand there's many, including some from the department, that don't believe this will actually happen. So I would encourage this committee that as we proceed and as we continue to work with the department, that we find language that more narrowly tailors this mandated premium reduction to language that actually addresses and recognizes the value of these improvements and the savings that companies and consumers will each see. We believe that language should include that premium discount or rate reduction is actuarially justified and there is sufficient and credible evidence of cost savings which can be directly attributed to the construction standards from the IABHS. We, of course, remain committed to working with both Chair Stevenson and the Department of Commerce to arrive at a solution that allows us to build as many of these fortified homes as possible without unfairly shifting the cost from one policyholder to another. Thank you again, Madam Chairman, for the opportunity to testify, and as always, happy to stand for questions.
Thank you for your time. Do any members of the public wish to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Members? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could Mr. Brickwood please come back?
He's here.
He anticipated your needs.
He knew I was going to call on him.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brickwoody, I have some questions for you. Unfortunately, we weren't able to see the graphs, but this is a question that's been kind of plaguing me about the increase in the number of claims and things. So if we go back to, say, 1980, and we then look at the time period from 1980 to 2022, that 42-year period of time, and I realize that you probably aren't going to be able to have a specific answer, but I think we can talk in generalities. Has the state of Minnesota's population grown substantially since that time?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, certainly since I've been here, yes. Yeah, because I added to it in that time frame, yeah.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And then those folks that have to have some place to live, and I'll kind of speed this along. So the seven-county metro area has probably grown significantly with the ground coverage, with dwellings and buildings and the like on there. Where in 1980, there might have been property where, if you will, the tornadoes, the hail, and things would have not damaged improvements that would be on these properties. Would that be a safe statement, Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think what you're describing is that over the course of recent time, our built environment has expanded out into places where severe weather is occurring, and so we're seeing extreme weather events interacting with our built environment more frequently, and so the severity of a storm may not be changing. I'll leave that to the climatologists, colleagues at DNR, but the cost from an insurance perspective of individual extreme weather events has gotten more expensive over that time frame that you've just described. I think, in fact, Mr. Cocking may be able to speak to this more than I can. I think sort of 1998 was a bit of an inflection point where we had storms that then began to happen more frequently, interacting with our built environment and having a more costly claims experience from that point on.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've spoke to the chair actually earlier today, and I said I'm in favor of this concept. What I guess I would like us to do is to work with a state like maybe Oklahoma that has a different model out there than Alabama, as you suggested, that this is modeled after, because I think that the state of Oklahoma probably has weather that's more compatible to the type of weather that we would see here, where you'd have hail and wind storms and damages along those kinds of things versus tropical storms and the things that could affect Alabama. They really don't probably ever have hail there, which are things that affect that. I'm also wondering that if in these numbers that we're looking at and the cost of going up has to do with increased regulation, building code standards and the like, because we have been hearing about the affordability of housing and different things, and a lot of that having to do with additional regulations, energy code, and the list goes on. So I would like to see those numbers adjusted for, if you will, 1980 standard, 2020, because I think a lot of the costs that are built into this that insurance companies have to pay are as a part of increased regulation and different building standards that are being implied. But I realize that that's not necessarily a part of this discussion. But to simply say, because we believe that there's a climate issue that's affecting this area, that's why we have these. As soon as you put more ground coverage and put improvements on those, you're going to have a larger exposure. I don't know that we've necessarily built out into areas that are more storm prone or weather disaster prone. I just think that's just a natural occurrence. Back in the day, 300 years ago, there weren't these structures. We had these kinds of weather events that came through, but it was, you know, hitting prairie grass. It was knocking trees down. It was kind of the natural ecosystem of things that were occurring on there. So again, I like the idea when homeowners and policyholders can receive benefits and savings on this. I just want to make sure that we're looking at something that's modeling Minnesota or closer to Minnesota, and that we don't just say, and it's an 8% discount, when we don't have the ability to actually back that up, because I think that will incentivize more people to step forward to do those kinds of things, because no one really likes to have to, particularly in this labor market, wait for 2 years or almost 2 years to be able to get their roof done, their siding done, and the like.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think a couple of points in response. Our good friends at the Oklahoma Insurance Department actually, I understand from them, are actually exploring a similar kind of grant program to what we're proposing here. And we would be the first Midwestern and first cold weather state to stand up a program like this. And you're quite correct that our risk profile, if you will, here in Minnesota relative to our weather experience compared to, say, Alabama's, is very different. But the standard that we're talking about here in terms of securing a roof deck, using hail-resistant shingles, The technical standards are designed to protect against wind. And I would posit to you, and the IBHS folks who were here last week made this statement in committee, that wind is wind regardless of where it's blowing or how it's coming from. So I think the standard is built to a peril, not necessarily a weather event. I think you're right in that we'll be building this sort of from the ground floor in terms of our experience relative to a program that's primarily been to date located in Gulf Coast states. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't translate to a place like Minnesota. To your point about cost reductions, too, I think you're quite correct in what you were saying about previous weather events interacting with unbuilt areas. I think our consideration is rooted in what the claims experience has been for insurance companies, because as you well know, there are only a few ways for an insurance company to respond to increased tightening in the market. You can either withdraw and eliminate your risk exposure completely, which we are seeing in other states that have been affected more severely by climate-driven crises like California or in Florida. Different perils in those states, but those property and casualty markets are either collapsed or on the verge of collapse due to the risk exposure that insurance companies find themselves in the position relative to their property and casualty markets. Or you can raise premiums, and you can collect more money to pay out more expensive claims. And your point is well taken about the sort of the inflationary changes over time, but the dollars that need to be collected need to be actuarially justified relative to the claims you need to pay out. I think what we're suggesting here is a third method that's been proven to work in other states, which is you can mitigate the risk by hardening or strengthening a structure that is insured and to make it more resistant to extreme weather events. And that can that principle can apply here in Minnesota the same way that it's been proven to be effective in other states. So, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm happy to continue to work with you on this. I would say to your point about the connection between the pricing of the value of the discount for consumers, I would agree with Mr. Cocking. We do need to make sure we have the right language here to make sure that that is actuarially justified, so that there's a connection between the insurance risk reduction for the insurance company and what's passed on to the consumer.
Representative Driscoll, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brickwood, you and I have worked very successfully on other matters that are within the scope of your department and the Department of Commerce, and I think we've been successful on that. And again, I would like to underscore the fact that I like the fact that folks can get an option to be able to save premiums, but I also want people to realize that when you put more development in an area, like you put more cars on the road, you're going to have more traffic, you're going to have more delays. It's just a function of growth, where some of those things you're just not going to be able to mitigate and the like on that. So thank you, Mr. Brickwood, and Chair Stevenson. Again, if we can save and have a legitimate reason without increasing risk and exposure and getting people in a situation where they're going to be in upside down on a policy, because to your point, Mr. Brickwood, if it's an arbitrary number and the insurance companies did their actual review and approval have to raise premiums, it doesn't do anybody any good at the end of the day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I have a question for Mr. Brickwood as well. Thank you. I do have the slide deck, and I'm looking at slide 3, the graph that you provided. And what I'm wondering, it's adjusted for inflation, so the total, and just to make sure I understand, it's the total cost of the weather event for the insurers, and that is adjusted for inflation across the different years. My question is, does it also adjust for things like the size, scope, cost of homes? Obviously, frankly, we're building much bigger homes today, much more costly homes today than we were building in 1980 that would naturally lead to higher costs. Is that accounted for in these numbers,
Mr. Brickwood?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know off the top of my head. With a few minutes of me not knocking things off the table, I could probably pull it up on the website and we could look at that together right after committee, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder if Mr. Cocking would stand for just one question quickly.
Mr. Cocking, when you're ready. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, happy birthday, Mr. Cocking.
Birthday.
You should have brought in treats, but whatever. Yeah, you're right. I should have. Similar question, but slightly different. If we're looking, and I don't know if you have seen the graph, but it gives the total dollars spent on weather events, and it's I assume it's just the most expensive. Well, I guess it's $1 billion weather events between 1980 and 2022. My question is, between 1980 and 2022, if we're talking, it looks like we're talking in real dollars, can I assume that population has increased significantly and that you are insuring far more homes? You were insuring far more homes in 2022 than you were insuring in 1980.
Mr. Cocking.
Madam Chair, Representative New, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay.
Representative Newberly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to make sure we understand that we're talking, you know, the way this is presented, we're talking about these dollars spent, but the reality is we're talking about that as though it's because these weather events are increasing, but the reality is there are a lot of confounding factors here. One, the costs of homes are significantly more expensive. We're building bigger. We're building more of them, and frankly, just the population has grown significantly since 1980. I don't know that Mr. Cocking has the number, but I suspect that there are more homes being insured by multiples.
Chair Stevenson.
Yeah, and I just wanted to comment on this because it's this one particular graph. I think the critique that Representative Brindley and Representative O'Driscoll are pointing out is fair. It's in real dollars. It's talking about the number of billion-dollar storms. But we've seen in this committee before other data that shows that, for example, the amount of premium increase that is attributable to extreme weather events is increasing. So when we are actually seeing specific to premium increases, premiums are going up because there are more extreme weather events. You know, there was some question earlier about are storms severe, more severe now? That's not in dispute. They definitely are. I mean, you can look at objective meteorological data that shows that the storms we're having today are more severe than they were a decade or 20 years ago. But more important than that, the frequency of severe storms are increasing. We're having more severe storms today than we used to. And regardless of how many people and growth, those are big problems that are driving costs. And I'm going to let Mr. Cocking speak to this too, but or ask Mr. Cocking to speak to this too. And the last thing I'd say is, and maybe he will say this in a second, but you know, Representative Driscoll asked, well, I wonder if regulations are also driving this. When we had a conversation at the beginning of this hearing, I actually put the question to Mr. Cocking whether how much of the premium increases we're seeing were due to these severe weather events, and I'll let him answer that. But I don't think Mr. Cocking is very shy. And it's probably nature of his disposition would be to say that if regulations were causing these premium increases, I'd have no doubt that he would aggressively make that case. So I guess the question for Mr. Cocking for me is, can you talk a little bit about the data as to premium increases being attributable to severe weather events?
Mr. Cocking.
Madam Chair, there is a lot to unpack there. I recognize this committee is on a
birthday
schedule
from the chair.
Thank you. I would say, kind of from a high level, whether it's additional houses that are being built, whether it's more people, whatever it is, we're still insuring those. And whether you have a hailstorm that goes through and hits a heavily populated area that maybe wasn't heavily populated before, the risk exposure to the insurer is still significant. It's far greater than maybe it was 20 years ago, but we have to price that in to what our premiums are going to be. And having if you're building out into the suburbs and you had a tornado that went through 30 years ago, you have five people that are impacted. You have a tornado that goes through now and you've got now a community of 15,000. That is a significant amount of additional risk that insurers are taking on that we have to not only collect premium for, but also pay out to make sure that those policyholders are made whole. And so that's the flip side. I mean, to Chair Stevenson's point, I mean, we are seeing additional storms with increased frequency, And by whether you measure it kind of on the weather side, which is, you know, I'm not the expert, I'm not going to talk about it, or you see it on the claim side, which is where we see it, and we're paying out. And I think I referenced that when I addressed this committee early on in session, that storms that we would have used to, that we would normally see come through every 100 years or every 50 years are now coming through every 5 years or every 10 years. And insurers have to price for that because the risk is that much greater.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Representative New Brindley, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. Just a question kind of about how the program works, and I'm somebody who just, I like having a standard like this, and I like the idea of having a, if the insurance companies are on board to offer a premium discount for a higher standard, I think that's awesome. But it looks in here like there's grant money. Can you kind of explain how that works? Are you putting... Thank you. to the from the department. Are you putting grant, and I understand that this is the language that goes along with an appropriation apparently that was in the governor's budget. Forgive me for not knowing about that, but how big of a program, how does this work? So a homeowner is going to seek out a contractor to improve their home, and then the contractor will get reimbursed if it gets built to a certain standard. Can you kind of describe that? And how much money, Madam Chair?
Mr. Brickwitty, if you could briefly, and then Representative Dowd will give you one follow-up. We got to wrap up here.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, be happy to meet with you to kind of walk through it in more detail. But the way you just described it is essentially the case. It's a $32 million appropriation for operations plus staffing for the agency to operate the program. The program would operate with residents of homes that are eligible to have the fortified roof standard put onto the building, would work with a contractor who's been through a training program that to learn how to do the fortified standard, and then the work is validated by a third-party independent evaluator who certifies that the work has been done to that standard, and that certification is maintained both by the home resident and IBHS itself. And so that third-party validation is part of the root of the actuarial justification for the risk reduction, because we know that, and there wouldn't necessarily be a dispute between a contractor and an insurer about whether or not the work has been done. It's been evaluated by a third-party entity. The department would operate the funds and would reimburse the contractor for the work done after the work is complete.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you. And I would like to visit with you offline about this too. Is this residential properties or commercial properties or both? And how many properties do you think $32 million is going to help?
Mr. Brickley.
Madam Chair, based on the experience from other states, we're aiming in our first years of operation to do about 1,000 homes each year. So that's based on some actual experience. I will note that we will need to build the workforce to be able to meet those goals, but that is our intent to start at about that point. That's what we're aiming for.
Thank you.
All right, members, I don't have anybody else left on the list, so Mr. Chair, I will give you closing comments.
The only thing I'll say to Representative Dowd is, Representative Dowd, that grant program, I mean, we have the policy language here. I think the money is gonna be in Chair Akam's bill. I mean, obviously explore, but just so you know, you aren't surprised when you don't see it come back later in this committee. Thank you for the time, Madam Chair. That's all I got.
Great. With that, Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 2300 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Members, we have nothing further on the agenda. Mr. Chair, do you have any last words for the committee? Okay. Then we are adjourned.